It's going to be a break and announcement and then the magazine to show. I'm just concerned about that. The plan B is to flip it and make it stick. So why you put your laptop on? You do plug in everything. And your... I guess you don't need it. In control of what you got to do. So.
Can you just plug the X1 and the
X5? Oh, sorry? Yeah.
I'm speaking to the people from the
speaker.
Okay. Because I want the machine, but I wanted that to be fixed back.
When Wonder was having a very hot art, it made us like the balance to get into cracked as well. So yeah, this was being cracked for somehow.
Good evening, welcome back.
Welcome.
Missing a few people. This is our grand finale, as promised. A discussion of ancient truth using the band video, understand where I'm coming from, as a point of entry. What we're going to do is we're going to play the video. Then we're going to cut to an interview with the Fallback, who actually directed and edited the video. This person was news to me. I only discovered, I wrote a blog for Thought Leader about an op-ed about this album. What I have done is I discovered that very little material about Prophet City is actually on YouTube. I had the video and I copied, I think, the masters about 20 years ago, copied them, had been digitized very recently, and then decided, well, nobody's going to actually put this up. It has historical value. People should be sharing this. I uploaded it to YouTube, wrote an op-ed about it for Thought Leader and Static Flow. Then out of the blue, this person emails me to say, I've got the shark of my life, went to the Magic Guardians, Thought Leader, read this article, saw the video. I'm late. This is the story we should look up. So that's the story. Then we cut to an interview with Shaheen. Actually, Shaheen and Lady D, but for the interest of time, I cut D out and D's here so he can speak for himself in person. So without further ado, I think we should cut to the video to give you a context if you haven't seen it already. Also, the question is, what is 4U City Summer School? And there's a second questionnaire for a USC doctoral candidate, Lori Hunter, in pink over here. Should really appreciate it if you could complete it and return it. No pressure. If you're not comfortable, then don't do it. But, you know, please be sure to fill out your banking details in the bank. Give that to me. Okay. So, let's kick in.
I'm not down with you, so don't be the one. Thank you. that you were in, and we had no access to any of the facilities of art commissions and paperwork and these kinds of things, and we had no access to the archive. So for me to use archive footage in that climate was a statement in itself, because, you know, what's the point of being unbanned if I can't show you Sharpeville, right? So the only way I could show that imagery was to do it subversively. So, at the time, Alien Barlow, who had been in the ANC Underground Film Unit, he had formed the first black film production company. There I was, you know, the one white girl always was always my like thing. There I was, the one white team, the black production company. The cultural disc or whatever, more militant than anybody, this was always the problem. But anyway, I got Amy with some of Wally's help to agree to produce this bloody video. So it involved like a whole lot of underground grapevine channel to get that footage out of that archive and into my hands. So we had a whole system that involved the SABC canteen, where we were going to the canteen, they would have put in a like innocuous request for, I don't know, CNN footage on spaceships or whatever. We'd filled out the requisitions, we'd hand it to our guy, and he of course would bring me back to see Rico or whatever else I want. Anyway, this went on for about 3 weeks. I couldn't sit and cut that video during working hours. Right, because you had like ears everywhere, you had people everywhere. They would like come in, just open your door, listen to what you're cutting. No, you haven't even seen the light of day. So I would sit from like 6 in the evening until 6 the next morning on that kind of shift to cut the bloody film. And I liked it rough, like I liked the rough cut that I'd made and wanted to polish. But there were certain things that I wanted to do in that footage that at that time you couldn't do in a regular edit suite. You needed like the first computerized suite, which at the time the SABC was called Henry. And one of my good friends, Michael Becker, was the main editor of Henry. So a bit of arm twisting, then we sat at 3 o'clock in the morning, again, polishing a POC video. And at that time, I think Henry was like 5 miles around an hour or something like that, which was a huge amount of money at the time. And the irony was that at a similar time, I was about to make Johannes Karpel's video, but I spoke no Afrikaans at all. And there I was doing POCs and Johannes's and not really understanding the language, but understanding the essence, so to speak. So we punished POC and it had to go to a final mix. And I tried very hard to get the sound dude that I thought was the least, you know, racist, the least inflammable to book for that final mix. And he was sick the day, or I don't remember what happened, but I walked into the sound suite, the guy stuck the tape in. We started the first verse. The three stands up and said, I refuse to cut this. I refuse to mix this. I won't go into the expletives that he used in Afrikaans, but just to say that he refused to do the mix. So, and yet, full of few strings, we actually did the sound mix outside of the SABC. We had to pay with our own money. We got followed by guards to our cars with our tape boxes. They were searched. I mean, from that moment on, every time we walked into the building, it was an ongoing search. Not to mention that we had people outside our houses, but I think we always like that because we were working in Shell House. So, constantly listening. Thank you. you were better by being willing to stand up. No one was measuring you sitting down in front of you.
When we actually recorded the album, we found out that the reason for Bach Studios to be built was part of the Bokuta Swana government to kind of, as part of broader publicity, marketing kind of thing, they wanted to present Bokuta Swana as a sovereign state, different from South Africa. And so they built the best studio in the southern hemisphere, and the idea was to attract the Michael Jacksons and whatever to record, you know, in the heartbeat of Africa, you know, that kind of, so this kind of curio shop thingy where it's like, you know, don't look for creativity in the hustle bustle of New York and London, you know what I mean? You want to come to home on the drum, you know, all of those kind of curio shop colonial kind of shit. They try to attract all the big artists, and they felt that if they recorded there, because they couldn't perform in South Africa, you know what I mean, due to the BDS campaign there, that would help boost Bokuta Swana's reputation on the world stage and all that. So we heard about this while we were recording, and that made it to the lyrics, right? Because Lucas Mangope was the kind of head of police. Yeah, exactly. That was a class briefing. Class briefing, isn't it? The doctor there was, in one of our lines, we were like, fuck Mangope, even if we record here. You know, that type of thing. And the guy who ran the studio at the time, like, he was fuming. He called the two of us into a meeting, this long ass table with all our masters there, the master decks. And fortunately, we made backups, like second generation backups of all the mixes. And so Ramon managed to get hold of the box, remember? Ramon managed to get hold of the box with the backup mixes, because they held the masters back. And so Ramon managed to grab the Bovierna while they were threatening us with stuff to say. What was the one thing he raised us? But by the hand that's feeding you. Yeah. Why do you bust the hand that's feeding you? Use our studio gear, we give the studio to you to use. So basically Mango Groove, us, and I think it was Timela at the time, because Ray Perry was there, right?
Yeah.
We could have access to the studio at like a crazy discounted rate to test out the studio, and also to basically use the music that come out of that to kind of entice the quality of the mixes and stuff like that, to entice other people to record there as well. So we were kind of like the experimental part of an experimental group. Anyway, so he was like, give the studio space to you for almost next to nothing and blah 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 blah. Like, how do you explain that to yourself? How do you live with yourself? And what was the conductor who said, in the same way Biko and Mandela does when they went to university, get that information to blow it. And we were like, and the Brahma was angry enough.
Yeah, I'll do
And I think from what I recall now, it's kind of vague, but I think the reason, because we basically spat with the backup masters, right? Because we remember we rushed out of that, so that was just to get to the border. We were like, come on! Get to the border of so-called South Africa, so they couldn't call in anyone. And I think they didn't make a whole fuss about that, because they didn't want that kind of negative publicity. Do you know what I mean? To kind of go after legal or something. I think that's kind of 194. But, so we felt at that time, when the album was released and everything, like, okay, now everyone does Sophia Khan. But we really underestimated the relationship between the state and corporations. Because what happened was, like they said, we, every single major festival we were booked on, we were cancelled. It was, Mitchell Splane's Musica had like, what, 5 copies of Age of Truth and like 100 copies of Guns N' Roses or something like that. Like, you couldn't find it in stores really, and we were, it was very difficult to make a living then as Prophets of the City after that album came out, because those relationships were very, very, very tight, and it was like, okay, you're gonna die on that? Why? It's like disaster. So we were in some ways forced to go outside of the country. And I mean, I'm not saying that we wanted to be provincial or anything like that. Like, you want to explore the world, but you at least want to explore the world on your own terms. And we made music for the Mitchell Splains and the Gooks, you know, and the Lavendales and the Langas and stuff like that. And to not have that kind of engagement, to have that music, have access to our brothers and sisters, it was blind painful in very many ways. You know, some of us have gotten a lot of flack by negating and rejecting colorism. You know what I mean? And embracing blackness in the way that we did, and it was like, yo, you don't have any colored groups, you have just like this one colored group that people identify with, and like, how are you out? Like, and now you're like, which, like, no colored, like, you know what I mean? And there was a kind of militancy in the way that we rejected coloredness that at times was very clumsy in the way that, in the same way that, you know, like, when you get, like, some lefties, you know, that are like lumming with Marx and Mitty Bartanasi, and then they treat other people that might not address those things almost like, yeah, you don't know shit. You know, that kind of thing, like they were born, they came out, reconstruction or whatever, and not realizing that you have this racial category, you know, that was in many ways hammering to people. Do you know what I mean? You're talking about parts of history where the conditions under which identities were created was extremely, extremely brutal, and the options people had to counter that were very Zaltis or Dalama.
Dalama.
Okay, what we're going to do now is we just need to have about 10 minutes of Q&A. We'll give Lady D a chance to speak to this person to get open it up to the floor. Then I'd like us all to do a special zip through the album with Lady D after that, but I want to give you a space to talk. Is that good?
Let me read your Q&A.
First, do you want to say anything yet?
I want to say something. I was one of those guys that bought
one of those 5 CDs at that musical.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I bought the one copy that was in the Golden Acre.
Jesus.
The one copy that was at the back. I had to travel all over the city looking for this thing, and people sneering at me. I'm watching for what I don't know.
Can I just add something, Adam? Actually, I bought the CD because at the time there was, I think there was Tribe Called Quest album that also dropped or something. But that was the album that I was getting for, right? And at the time I was working at the convenience store called OK's in the town center. So I got paid and I was like, you know, I need to go buy this album. Bought the album, got into the taxi, sat in front. And the taxi driver asked me, what CD is that? I'm like, Prophets of the City, HPT, no, the Prophets of the City. It's like, okay, put it in. So, you know, taxi, 40 people in a taxi, I'm sitting right in front. He pops it in. the first 10 seconds, he's like, no, put it off. Ah, put it off. I was like, so sad. Okay, so she did.
should it be that? Okay. Yeah, let me come up here.
Just a very quick comment. I was really drawn to how the issue of is black, is colored, and blackness then becomes what we used to say in the Black Liberation Movement, a state of mind. Not your ancestry, not your color. And it's really drawn to how that theme played out over here.
I got a question for the artist in thinking about this, Ready D specifically. So in hip hop in the States at that time, blackness was so front and center, and black identity was everything. You know, that almost every song that you heard, even if it was about the club or party, and you had a verse that was about blackness or Africa or something, right? It was about being black. And so I wonder, when we talk about hip hop moving all around the world, one thing that I notice and that scholars write about is the shifting, the way local paradigms of race and constructions of race and systems of race get shifted through ideologies of race that move in through rap music,
yes,
you know, or hip hop culture. So in what ways were you thinking about, I mean, were you thinking about, oh, the US has a different system of racial classification than ours, but let us adopt and adapt blackness to our circumstance? Or what was the process? Were you thinking about that specifically, or?
Yeah, thank you for that. As sort of our connection with hip-hop as a culture, we sort of from the first generation of hip-hop heads in South Africa, if you want to call it that. So we obviously had quite a deep connection to the likes of Kool Herc, Afrika Bambaataa, Afrika Islam, and those types of personalities using hip-hop as a medium to broker peace between gangs, and that's how the birth of the Zulu Nation sort of came together. And I think that was probably our interpretation of hip-hop's first entry point into the consciousness realm. And from that, we then learned about the Black Panthers, the Five Percenters in New York, as well as the Nation of Islam as well. And then there's various other groups through hip-hop that were delivering very strong sort of, if you want to call it, black conscious or proud to be black messages. And of course, KRS-One with his tempo of hip-hop and the Stop the Violence movement, we could relate to all of those things. And at one stage, we were so deep into what was coming from the US, and when hip-hop started going through that black conscious phase, we were taking a very deep look at ourselves, because at one stage, you were trying to emulate what was coming from the US. And at this point in time, it was so serious, we thought, well, if the brothers and sisters in the US are all sporting these African medallions and they're wearing the dashikis and, you know, all those type of images and messages are coming through, well, we should actually be taking more, I just say we should be taking note of what's taking place right here on our doorstep, but we are African, you know, so we are being celebrated abroad as well. And I think that was the turning point for us. And with the country slowly going through this transition, and with the turmoil, the harassment, the flak, the type of imagery, bombs going off, people being assassinated, you know, that even drew us closer to, if you want to call it, becoming more conscious and aware. So you start reading more literature, you start coming across Marcus Garvey, you start reading Steve Biko, you know, guys are pulling literature from all over. There's discussion groups. We had little lecture sessions where there's like 4, 5, up to 10 of us sitting in my mom's living room on a weekly basis, just trying to get ourselves educated, because as we said in the video, we didn't you can't expect that type of education behind the school benches. That was non-existent. You know, the type of things that we were taught, the messages that were that we were fed is to think of us as being inferior because all the images was white. It's the white God, the white Jesus, as Boot and Sarki, Mark and Kathy. Those were the type of stories that we grew up with from kindergarten, if you want to call it that. You know, and, if, and the level of demoralization, if I think about it, it's still beyond belief that human beings could actually do that to other people. You know, the way that they segregated us, it's right through from your hair texture, the size of your lips, your skin color. You had to go there and they'd measure your lips. They would measure and roll their fingers and put pencils through your hair to establish whether you're African, whether you're colored, whether you're Malay, as those types of things. And then it's stamped in your pass, in your ID documents, and you needed a pass to go from one area to the other area. So growing up as a young boy, not aware of these things, and all of a sudden, it's almost like an overnight switch. A switch went on, it's just like overnight, oh my Lord, look what's happened to us. You know, we really, really need to deal with this issue point blank, because it was almost like the apartheid government put a state of emergency in place. We also felt that we needed to counter that with our interpretation of a state of emergency, to counter that as well. And I guess thinking back and looking at the images, that's probably what that was, you know, in one sense.
Can I just explain very quickly? Dee mentioned Boetin Sarki and Kathy and Mark. For those of you who don't know, in South African, Kathy and Mark was a leader. If he was sub A, the equivalent of day one. If he was sub A, in English class, you'd get the Kathy and Mark leader. And of course, for Afrikaans, Boetin Sarki and Boet. Sarki and Boet, you know, brother and sister. Sarki is the, what do you call it, proclaimer? What is proclaimer in English?
I'm not even going to go there. I didn't pay attention.
Sarah, basically. Little Sarah. Can't believe I can't translate something from Afrikaans into English. I used to be Afrikaans speaking. So, why do you so much? I'm also just theory speaking. Theory speaks me. So, the point I'm making is these readers, the Afrikaans readers, Boetin Sarki, were. The characters were white, the family was white, it was an intersexual nuclear family, even though black people in the narrative. So if you were South A coming into this, imagining, you know, coming into literacy, becoming literate, learning to read, you had to imagine these white kids, these white protagonists, Afrikaner protagonists. If you were in the English class, Kathy and Mark, you had to imagine a white American middle class family, because that's what Kathy and Mark was, white American, right? Heteronormative, race-specific, a whole other stuff. So that's sort of socialization, that's what you're talking about. So for me specifically, and I think Dee as well, being about the same age, you'd have come out of 76 in the townships into schools learning what Kathy and Mark were doing in Sarki. Having just gone through 76 and seen that kind of brutality. The first white people you encounter are men in boots with rifles. Right? And then you get Kathy and Mark in boots Sarki. It's sort of contradictions, right? So that's one part of it. What I also wanted to point to is, I think for Dee, I think people's experiences will differ. For Dee, am I correct in saying that your conscientization happened through hip-hop and exposure to people like Shaheen, who's already down that road?
Yes, that's correct.
So someone like Shaheen was a class clown, co-opted into the student's representative council, I believe, right? So from being, do you think he's so funny? Why don't you serve in the SRC and get involved? Right? But you might even be Marty's, and he was like, all right, I'll walk, and I'll make you pay for it, right? So, obviously, he sees the opportunity to be using hip-hop. Well, really, his father was of a generation of jazz musicians who come out of a sort of black consciousness era, right? And what was jazz doing? Jazz was defying colonial segregation, racial segregation. So places like District 6 and Sapphire Town were places, they were melting pots. People would come there for the music and be on people of all races and classes. It would be not like this at all. So far, it had to be broken down and became tired, triumph, right? Tired, time to what? We kick your ass, that's what's white supremacy, right? Tired. That's when it becomes segregated. Everyone goes up to the locations. White folk people is bundled off. There's a story of a journalist who had an affair, a drunk journalist, with a white woman. And I think she ended up in Australia or something like that. But they were just completely vilified. Same thing happens in District 6. The place gets broken down. The musicians, the artists who come from those spaces, they all get sent off and dispersed. But Ray Hunt was one of these people who sort of drew a diverse people to her, and was one of the sort of key hands of District 6 campaigners. And her home was one of the last folks to be lodged. She ended up in Giants, basically, in a council flat. That's where she died. So that's sort of narrative. So the jazz generation was already embracing BC. It was already mobilizing. It was a site of resistance. And then, you know, that's BC Alekhine's generation. And then his son, Shahin Alekhine, becomes a founding member of Crocus. So there's already this sort of continuity. It's just generations coming in at different levels, setting things off. And as I suggested in one of the early lectures, what had happened before Crocus existed, or Black Noise existed, there was Sandile Dikene, there was the Sekho Lampolo King. There were a lot of other poets, playwrights, novelists, Wale Soroti, who gets referenced in one of the early interviews, doing great poetry to Yeti Burton's Blood, probably one of the most phenomenal novels to come out of this country, totally underrated. So there's this sort of history. It's not as if like people discovered hip hop and it set it off. And we were inspired by these Americans. And, American hip hop could save us. Kanye, come and save me. with your J6. Right? That's not what happened. It's just a bunch of people seeing the opportunity, recognizing the resonance. And, culture is bricolage. You draw on the means at hand. So jazz musicians did that. Ironically, if you look at the work of Dave Copland and Van Allman, you'll see that American, African-American jazz musicians looked to Africa for inspiration. And it was a two-way thing. So the Coltranes and the Negus of the world, it was a two-way thing already that was going on. And part of that was an ideological orientation. The assertion of blackness, which is ideological, not founded in biological essentials. Notions of identity, which is what I think you were getting at. Yeah.
I really like that last point you were making, and it helped me sort of think about something else that I want to maybe explore a little bit more that I've been thinking about, because I've written some stuff on the relationship between Islam and hip-hop culture. And I think it's interesting. I don't know, of course, all the stuff that's out there that's written about Cape Tony and the South African hip-hop. But it seems to me like a lot of the connection, we talk about blackness and race a lot, but a lot of the connection was also Islam in that moment, in that particular moment. And I'm a little bit surprised by almost how dominant Islam was in the sort of early hip-hop community here. This, of course, the same thing was in the United States, where so much of the hip-hop was Islamic-oriented in various communities, as already Dee mentioned. But we always talk about the race and the race connections, and I wonder about what were the sort of religious connections or spiritual connections, because there's a very spiritual movement at the core of blackness and black consciousness for African Americans. Like, it's not just a political movement or whatever. Like, for people involved, there's also a spiritual movement. And so I wonder the resonance. Adam, you mentioned the resonances, and so I wonder what resonances were also seen in that way now. That's a big question,
and that's quite a big question. That's going to take quite a bit of assistance. But just from my perspective, I embraced Islam because of the consciousness that came through hip hop. And the reason why I did that is also learning a little bit more about my roots in terms of where, if you want to call it, my family and my ancestors come from as well. Although we got this European African connection, we also have connections that go as far back as Java. If you look at the East, you look at India, you look at all those places. And because of the Dutch East India Company, that was one of the companies, if I'm I stand to be corrected, but they obviously had certain routes that they dominated, spice routes and so forth. Cape Town was one of the stopping points, and they would bring in quite a lot of slaves from abroad, and it was a lot of Muslim slaves that came to settle in Cape Town, as well as slaves coming from elsewhere in Africa as well. And I thought it was very interesting that I have Muslim family members and Christian family members, and I was a little bit confused about everything. My dad was Muslim, converted to Christianity, my sister's Muslim, so it's all these things taking place, and just learning a little bit more about that and my personality and character at the time, I felt I couldn't in layman's terms, I couldn't find my bearings within Christianity, kind of learning about its history and how it was enforced upon our people. And if you trace it back to the days of slavery, you know, there were certain there's certain stories that if you wanted your freedom, you had to become Christian and you had to buy yourself out of slavery as well. So to a certain degree, there was a huge you couldn't budge. That was it. And also kind of learning a little bit about the links when it comes to the Muslims joining forces with the local, or should I say the indigenous Khoi people of Southern Africa as well. They formed various movements and militias to counter what was happening as well. And that's a lot of information and a lot of history that's not freely available, unfortunately. You know, you got to go to a mosque, or you got to sit with the elder or dig deep. So for our general, if you want to call it the general, community, unfortunately, you know, that information that's not circulating unless you come to, you know, these types of environments as well to come and learn a little bit more about that. But for me, once again, I felt that it made sense because I needed to understand my history a little bit more, and knowing my ancestry came from the East. You know, 10 to 1, they were Muslim, and that's what I needed to embrace. You know, I couldn't embrace anything else that meant oppression to me. So that was.
So it's understand where I'm coming from is a message to people, but also an understanding of where I'm coming from.
Yes. Yes.
At the same time.
And on that note, which one is it? Is it at the very beginning of the argument of Age of Truth? It's either United We Stand or Divided We Fall. The very beginning, all those samples. You actually sampled Dakomi Alibaba, right?
Yes.
Of one of those two, Dakomi Alibaba, and I believe you were at a wine farm where the Stanford people in Lou went to a wine farm, and people there sang some Kaapse Klopse likkies, right? Lekker likkies, it's all innocuous, it's lovely likkies, songs, ballads, and one of the songs was Dakomi Alibaba. I think you did. I'm told I wasn't there to gossip. I was trying to put it back. I think someone's worth it. He's a professor, but he never knows. So, Dark pulls the Alabama. Here comes the Alabama. So, this is the song. So, you have these minstrels. I'm tweeting in the yard. The only day that the slaves can actually occupy the city, the day off, they perform these songs. The song is not called the Alabama, and you know, the slave masters double coded, they don't necessarily get what it means, it's not clear. Double coded speech in the Hebrew gets sense of the term, right? So, what is the Alabama? You know, the Alabama.
Sorry,
okay, let me get to the point there. The Alabama is a Confederate ship, right? Bringing Sheikh Yusuf to South Africa as a political prisoner. He had been naughty, we've been resisting Dutch colonialism. Get the hell out of our country. Immigration needs to be tightened up here. Get out. No. You're sending you off. Okay. And this arrival of Sheikh Yusuf is credited as the official arrival of Islam to the Western Cape. So Islam's arrival in the Western Cape is synonymous with struggle, anti-colonial struggle. So it's no surprise then, this is a long history of resistance. Islam as an alternative to, you know, Christianity and all that it represents, colonial oppression, internalization of neocolonial.
Sorry, Adam. I'm sorry to cut in. No, time. I just just wanted to latch on to what Dee was saying. Another factor to that was also the literature that we've got. You know, because there was a figure known as King Jamo. We used to get information, alternative information, from the Universal Zulu Nation, you know, in New York. And he's one of the figures, you know, that doesn't get mentioned in South Africa anymore. And he's a figure that, you know, shared this information with us. Furthermore, you also have to understand, we also had a nation of Islam back in the day of the base and stuff like that. And I mean, me also, not coming from a Muslim household, because I'm a Scottish Catholic, I had a Scottish Catholic upbringing. I mean, I got influenced by that as well, you know. So I also want to put that in perspective as well.
You know, if you cut to the album with Dee and Azul.
Yeah, my question's for Dee and Azul. Just in the context of Adam mentioning that Shahid's dad was like a jazz musician, I'm just wondering, like, how explicit was the connection in the 80s and 90s between hip-hop and jazz in Cape Town? Because, like, on the Cape Flats or whatever, I mean, now you've got guys like Yitzfinger playing Afrikaans with Carl Shepherd, and
yes,
it's like that coming together of the Cape jazz tradition and hip-hop tradition. So, yeah, was it just like the sons and daughters of jazz music, like, taking that sensibility forward into hip-hop? Or were there like jams going on with young guys who were playing jazz as well? Or, like, what was it like?
I would say with Shaheen's dad playing a very important role in POC as a producer, that was the first link between jazz and hip-hop in our country.
And he played on the album.
That's correct. Yeah,
and
he was
with Sia, okay, Crusader, one of the coolest Cape Town songs ever.
I shall correct you, as I'm a POC fan. Actually, the first actually, the first South African hip-hop and jazz track was actually on the second POC album, and the track was called Musical Madness.
Oh, yeah.
That is actually South Africa's first, you know, jazz meets hip-hop, for the first time officially.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to counter that. The POC fan. is Roots on that album, or is Roots on the first album?
Roots on the
first
album.
Okay. I just gotta tell the story very, very, very quickly. We were sitting in Shaheen's dad's little studio, producing music, and I always tell the story because I think it's a really phenomenal story, and I'm still trying to make sense of it. Knowing Shaheen's dad and his dad's record collection, but I didn't quite understand jazz music. I heard it in the community, but I didn't understand it. And my motivation for getting involved with Shaheen is I wanted to be a ghetto superstar. When I met him, I heard his dad at the studio, and I'm like, dude, when can I record an album? Because I need to make some money, you know. I need cars, I need clothing, I need the whole story. Rapper's Delight, that for me was... that was the word right there. Knicks playing basketball, and it's color TVs, and it's swimming pools. Those things were foreign to us. And I'm like, I like what these guys are saying, and the way I'm going to get that is to get into a recording studio and record that stuff. Anyway, we're in the recording studio, and I'm checking out Shaheen doing his thing and writing his lyrics, and Shaheen's talking to me about Mandela and Biko and what's happening in school, and I'm like, brah, don't talk about those things. Knicks play basketball and color TVs. Let's talk about that. You know, that's kind of the vibe, because I'm in a hurry over here. You know, we're selling beer bottles and we're selling scrap iron to afford sneakers so that we can style and profile when we go battle on the streets, because we started off as B-boys. And while sitting in the recording studio one night, Shaheen flipped out his records, and on the turntable, he drops his vinyl and he drops the needle. And there's a jazz song, Afro jazz song, that plays, and it's Abdullah Ibrahim, better known as Dollar Brand. His song plays Little Boy. I don't know what happened to me personally. Everything changed. My whole life changed, my perspective, everything changed. And right then the lyrics, everything just transformed at that point in time. And that was probably my entry level, once again, into becoming conscious. And it wasn't, the music, the artist, wasn't related to hip-hop whatsoever. There was an energy, there was a truth, there was a level of persuasion you know, that changed everything for me. So that was kind of, you know, the first connection. And then we wrote a song called Roots Resurrected on our first album that that sort of, it's a tribute to Afro jazz, the likes of Hotep, Galeta, Abdullah Ibrahim, Robbie Jansen, that is some of the local jazz musicians, and of course Pacific Express, a band that Shaheen's dad belonged to.
We were going to run through the entire album with you quickly, but we can't. But can we give them a taste of Cape Crusade at least introduction, as a ghetto code? Because that is the best, and the saxophonist is?
Cape Crusader. I think the saxophonist on that track, sure, stand to be corrected, it could be Robbie Jansen. That we sample that track from a Pacific Express album, and the original version was recorded in the early 70s, and the guys didn't write the track, it was a jam session. That's what that was all about. And they just decided to record the jam session, and we were listening to some albums for interesting samples to use, and when we latched onto that thing, we didn't have lyrics to the music. The music dictated everything.
Check it out.
Sad to say that the censorship issue started internally with management. As Shaheen has said on, you know, in his first verse, and a lot of issues that we had to deal with was trying to fight for what we believed in, the type of music we wanted to produce. On the other end, with a lot of attention coming from the SABC and the censorship boards starting to reject certain tracks, you know, we were kind of pushed into the direction where the music had to become a little bit more commercial. And on Boom Style, that's quite evident, because there's quite a lot of commercial sounding songs. Other producers were brought in. We were muscled into using other recording studios because management believed that this is the way to go. If you want to survive in the industry, you want to eat, you want to be successful, unfortunately, you're going to have to tone down everything. And on that album, we decided, man, we can't do that. It just doesn't feel right. Morally, it doesn't feel right. And we squeezed in a track called On Stem. And that was kind of our counter to the previous apartheid government's national anthem called Distem at the time. And that was the last track that we recorded in Cape Town. Everything else was recorded in Joburg. And we had to fight tooth and nail to get that track onto the album. At least, you know, you got to have some degree of principle, you know, with putting music and expression out into the arena over there. Then there was a song that appeared on the album called Kicking Nonstop. We recorded that music video in the SABC studios. And then MC Hammer was the rage, and CNC and the Music Factory and all those type of poppy songs. And then SABC decided to bring in some really jiggy dancers in the music video. They had these tight leotards putting MC Hammer moves and those type of things. And we couldn't cope with that. And we thought, okay, why don't we at least, you know, somehow or some way we got to say something. And right at the end of that music video, there was a refrigerator standing in the studio at the SABC's television recording facility. And we decided, and there was a picture of former President P.W. Botha hanging on the wall as well. And we thought, man, can't we just take that picture off the wall very quickly and maybe put that pic inside the refrigerator, close the door, and just say, chill out, homeboy. And that's exactly what we did. This really poppy music video went out, and everybody was like, yeah, kicking nonstop, cool dancing. Wow, look at the cool dudes now, you know. And at the end, you see the fridge door open, the picture goes in, and boom, the door closes. And right then that music video was banned, and we had to cut out that portion of the video. And on stem, that was banned as well. You know, that we got this really hectic letter from the SABC, you know. And from there, one thing led to the another. We recorded the third album, Funk Flow, that didn't get any... Sorry, it was Age of Truth. And when after we came from Maputo Tswana, after the story that Shaheen delivered in the clip, I think the whole country was terrified of Prophets of the City. They probably thought these guys have gone terrorist mad, because they're firing shots left, right, and center. And we were scheduled to perform at former President Nelson Mandela's inauguration. On the morning of the event, we received a call. You guys can't perform at the event anymore. And our manager fought. We fought. We were threatening with newspaper, every single channel at our disposal we were going to use to expose these people. Then they decided, you guys can perform, but you're not allowed to set up your decks and you can't use your music. And we were like, oh Lord, what are we going to do? We actually had a journalist on the Source or Rapage just follow us to cover the story. And then we were like, oh my gosh, but we got Jasmo. Jasmo was one of the members. He was a beatboxer. And we thought, okay, that's the way to go. Jasmo, you beatbox, we'll rhyme, we're still going to do our things. And that's the way we pulled off that performance at Mandela's inauguration. So that was, you know, just some of the censorship stories from our perspective. Over here.
So even as we were making the transition into the market on paper, the fact is, Funk Flow post-election,
yes,
and the Gethoco definitely post-election.
Universal Soldiers as well.
Universal Soldiers. It was just like, it was you know, no dots all the way.
Yeah, and understand where I'm coming from. One foreign music, a foreign
Medium.
Music video award.
Is it
the Medium? Yes, a Medium, yeah. And we got exposure, but it was a very small little story in the newspaper, and it just came and went, that's it, boom. And for any artist at that point in time to achieve anything, even if you got a gig, it was a big thing for South Africans at the time. And, you know, that was just swept under the carpet as well, because I think people still felt that threat. And we were still seen as a colored group from the Cape Flats. And the National Party had a stronghold on the Western Cape. So for an outspoken / militant voice, and it's young guys coming from the Cape Flats, and the National Party still fighting for votes in the Western Cape, it was very dangerous for them to allow a group such as Prophets of the City to become sort of more successful or more vocal. So that was also part of the reasons.
I wish we could speak some more. But what I want to do is to draw your attention to the present day. For those of you who don't know, that's a painting by Brett Murray. It appeared in the Goodman Gallery just the morning after I was about to battle a publisher and on the censorship issue in my own book, right? This exhibition went down in Joburg, a whole series of critiques and parodies of Zuma, but critiques basically of corruption, nepotism, lack of transparency, consumer culture in the ANC. The Spear literally references the Lenin poster, right? So of course, the links reference to communism, the history, the so-called communist history, socialist ideology embraced by the ANC completely being flipped over by this neoliberal turn, the flaccid penis referencing the rape trial and remarks that Zuma made during his rape trial. He was acquitted, but the remarks that he made during the rape trial, the sexist remarks, and the assertion that, you know, that he's a Zulu traditional male, all of those things being referenced in here, the remarks he made were more damning than the possibility of being a rapist. He was acquitted. So I think, you know, produced a whole lot of critiques, spin off spoofs. So what happens is, you know, in the gallery, the painting gets defaced by two people, unrelated to each other. That's the one thing. But while this is going down, you know, court action is launched to sue, but in order to pull this painting and maybe also to get newspapers to stop publishing pictures of the painting, you needed to prove that it was defamation. So it was going to be a long road. First you have to prove that it's defamation, blah, blah, blah. There's a good defense, he's a public figure, everything that he does, you know, news and critiques, protected by Section 16 of the Constitution, which guarantees free speech, artists are covered by this, journalists, etc., etc., they probably wouldn't get away. So instead of pursuing that court action, they basically abandoned that and took to the streets, rolling mass action. It's used 80s and 90s rhetoric. We will march on the gallery, we will pressurize the editor of City Press, she must take this picture down from her website. So this intimidation. Eventually, the editor of City Press, Fidel Hafiji, says, you know what, I'm getting intimidated. My journalists now can't work in the field. They can't access trade union meetings because they're being locked out, threatened, etc., etc., for the safety of my staff, anxious to get everyone to chill the hell out. I'm going to just take the picture down from the website. After the fact, she says, I regret doing that. But at the time, it was really, really difficult. Press meeting, press conference, with the gallery owners saying that, you know, basically taking a step back. And it all looks like they're being muscled to actually, you know, capitulate, right? So it's all very threatening. So even though legal channels weren't used, intimidation was used, right, to actually shut this whole thing down. And I'm thinking to myself, how different is the outcome of, you know, the Spear and journalist coverage of the issue, how different is that from the experience of Prophets of the City? Right? The damning parallels is really, 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 really tricky. And of course, one of the lightning rods in the media context is someone named Zapiro, who has produced a number of critiques. The original critique that he offered was the rape of Lady Justice, with members of the Tripartite Alliance holding Lady Justice down as Jacob Zuma is about to violate her, right? And here we have, you know, free speech about to be violated as well. This is his critique of what happened, you know, during the Spear debacle. But here's the catch. The critique of Spear's critique is that he's banalizing rape, gender-based violence, that gender politics takes a backseat to the politics of the ruling party, that the one is illegal for the other. So it's part of his replicating the problem here from a gender perspective. So there are all sorts of levels of complexity here that are worth considering. If you want to read up a little bit more about this, yes, this was also applied to something that I wrote, like yesterday. Second frame here. Check out a book called State of the Nation 2014. The HSRC Press publishes something called State of the Nation on a yearly basis, and it's sort of like, you know, a thermometer. how's the country doing, other range of areas. So there's an article about this very issue in State of the Nation 2014, also in, I think, the first chapter, 3,000 words in the first chapter of the book Static, also discusses this, it's worth looking at, especially in relation to the story of censorship in the 90s. What I want to say is, Prophets of the City's own experience of censorship, the difficulty that they had in accessing audiences and distributing their work, the complicity of corporates with the state, is a very, very important story. But I think that experience is not singular. Roger Lucy wrote a book about this, made a documentary about his own experiences as a musician being harassed by the cops, but then also having to deal with the corporates. Michael Durant, a scholar from Rhodes University, has done a lot of research on largely white rock bands and the attempts to sort of show the middle finger to the power and the difficulties that they faced and the corporate complicity in that equation as well. So much so that some of these artists started something called shifty records. To just literally shifty, as in shifting about, the studio was in a caravan and they would go wherever to record whoever wanted to be recording. One of those artists was Mizrahi, right? So they weren't just white rockers and punks recording music with shifty, it was also people like Mure. So very, very important story. Check him out, Michael Durant, done a lot of stuff on that. And on that note, sadly we have to call it today. If you do have energy and time tomorrow, 5:30 I believe, we have Williams, the filmmaker, will be screening the film Hip Hop Revolution. Check the website for details on that. I believe it's still going down, I'm not sure. Well worth checking out. It talks about hip hop's emergence from the 80s into the 90s in Cape Town specifically. Thank you so much, and thanks to our participants.
Thank you very much. Oh yeah, yeah, that was crazy. That's the first time I hear that. That's news to me. That yeah, we didn't even know. We know that there was like crap going on behind the scenes, but I didn't know to what extent. Yeah,
because I didn't know what to watch.
That's right, yeah.
And
certain albums are nailed as well, they're scratched over.
I've
got one of 200 albums around me. That was scratched up. Stevie Wonder records.
Yesterday we were looking for you.
Sorry, I had to duck because you guys were something for Venice time.
No, you could have just came and I could have fucking the other one right.
Yeah, I do. I hope your Mac will read it. I had sometimes trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
I
have
with
1992.
No,
1991. Those look like mint copies of Our World and Boomstar, which you got 1991.
Actually, you know what? I had the mint copies yesterday. And it's just waiting for you because the ones that I have on my laptop are not in the exhibition at all.
Because
of the Nation of Islam, and that's how we started to think. It was kind of like, if we're going to rap, we're not going to rap for the Nation of Islam, we're going to rap, like rapping for Jesus kind of vibe. But it was heavy when I heard about, if you've heard about today, because of the affiliation to NOI, it was almost like rap was a good sort of thing. It wasn't.
Because of. That crazy
compared to what the teachers are, complete opposite.
On the one hand, the message is the community.
You can read from the enemy. Can you read from me?
But other people like you.
Because
if you don't have the courage of, you know, I am not worthy to be with us for that, you know, issues.
Yeah, of course. I can, yeah, but I can't copy it. Okay, so greet.
Thank you.
turn that into a factory or whatever it is. And you see, so you've got ingredients there. Those are fun levels and skills and your advances as well.
Thank you.
Really?
Yeah, but we will come afterwards. That's the show. That's the show.
But I hope so.
An hour doesn't do it justice.
I think each of these sessions could have been a 3-hour session. We probably still wouldn't have covered all the ground.
No, for sure. We get it.
And we used to share that strange love. What happened to it?
Turned into a lab. They took the entire top floor and turned into a lab. There are no computers
there. People bring their own computers, don't they?
I don't think they do.
I
don't know if you like me, you have a crappy old laptop that can't be taken anymore. That's what happens when you get divorced. You had the laptop in undergrad, now it's
DJs, can we take a group picture? Hola, can you?
We just want to be the guy that splits about
50
people.
Yeah. the African diaspora and how it's kind of shaped and remade through online hip hop. And so it's basically about your experience with the diaspora and your engagement with the internet and kind of
would you?
Yeah? Okay. Well, I'm having some. She's having one of my bags.
Noch ist in der Schule.